Welcome to the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I'm Kyla Daw, and I'm glad you decided to join us on today's episode of the show that is shaping how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Rather than advice from experts, our listeners want to hear the insights and ideas from those who, just like them, are on the front lines every day, building meaningful relationships that translate into meaningful support for causes that they and their donors care about. Every week, we invite our guests to have a real conversation about what it means to be a fundraising professional. We're after a greater understanding of what it means to be one of the sector's critically important yet least understood roles, while giving honest answers to our profession's most difficult questions. Thank you for joining us in this episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. Here's your host, author, fundraiser, and master trainer, Jason Lewis.
Hi, podcast listeners. This is Jason Lewis, and I am your host for the Fundraising Talent Podcast. I want to thank you for joining us today for the show that is shaping the way that the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent. Before I introduce today's guest, I do want to thank our sponsor, QBAC. QBAC is a next-generation advancement solution that reimagines alumni engagement to increase major planned and principal giving. QBAC acts as a force multiplier for fundraisers, enabling them to focus on what they do best, developing deep relationships with prospects and cultivating them into lifelong donors. QBAC automates the qualification process beyond simple scoring to ensure that your fundraisers have the best prospects. QBAC also uncovers actionable insights about current and future prospects to help fundraisers develop personalized cultivation strategies. Start closing bigger gifts in less time by going to www.qbac.com to schedule a free demo. Also, how about being our next host for the Responsive Fundraising Roadshow? I'm looking forward to two things this summer: getting back to the ballpark with my kids and getting the Responsive Fundraising Roadshow back on the calendar. If your organization would like to be a host location, let's schedule a time to chat. The Responsive Fundraising Roadshow provides 6 hours of the best fundraising training out there based on Responsive's 4 sense-making tools. Hosting Responsive's Roadshow is not like hosting a major conference that requires months of planning and all types of resources. All we need you to do is provide us with a safe learning environment for 25 adult professionals in your community who want to understand how highly effective fundraising really works. There is no cost to your organization, and we will reimburse you for all related expenses. If your organization would like to host the Responsive Fundraising Roadshow in your community, reach out and let's have a conversation today. Hi, Carl. I am delighted to have you on the Fundraising Talent Podcast today. Before we dive into our conversation, which I'm very much looking forward to, I haven't been here on the podcast in a while, so I'm kind of ready to warm up. I was traveling for a couple of weeks, so I'm kind of glad to be back in my seat, back behind my laptop and my microphone. So, and I'm glad to kick off this week with you, Carl. Tell us who you are.
Yeah, my name is Carl Brady. I am currently the donor relations manager at Carolina Youth Development Center in North Charleston, South Carolina. We're a residential group care facility, so we host kids in foster care, ranging in age from kind of middle school age to age 21, as we help them transition into adulthood. And then we also do community-based prevention services that help parents not enter the foster care system and develop parenting and life skills. And then I moonlight on Charleston City Council, where I represent District 5, which is the Outer West Ashley portion of the city of Charleston, as well as Johns Island.
Yeah, when you reached out, that kind of intrigued me. And I got to say, I have to, well, first of all, I got to tell you, and I didn't share this with you before we hit the record button, but my wife and I met and married in Savannah. And at the time, we didn't have much to, too many pennies between the two of us to rub together. So we honeymooned in Charleston. And then for several years thereafter, we would return to, this was before we had the 4 kids that we have now. In fact, the last time we spent our anniversary in Charleston, our oldest, who is now 18 years old, was probably about a year old. And we stayed at that, there's a campground with a little water park and stuff on James Island. Does that sound familiar? Is it still there?
That sounds right. Yep.
Yeah. So that was our first attempt at camping as a young family, as you can imagine. And it was quite an enjoyable, it was quite an enjoyable trip, but we haven't been back a whole lot. What's it like to be in Charleston? Before we dive into our conversation, what is it like to live in Charleston, raise money in Charleston with the big black bod? That's got to be a big deal, right?
Yeah, so Black Bod's a great corporate partner for a lot of nonprofits here in Charleston. Yeah. And, you know, they're great at sending volunteers out, as well as not just helping out sponsorship-wise with nonprofits, but also they're very good just being involved in the community overall. And they give through various means. But raising money in Charleston's been great. We have a really involved philanthropic community. Yeah. And that was actually one of the things when I was looking to move to Charleston, I pulled some of the 990s for just various nonprofits, and the net asset position on most of them was excellent, which showed that, you know, fundraising was, well, not a piece of cake. Fundraising was going to be, a good thing to get into here in town.
Yeah. I think the other thing my wife and I appreciated about Charleston differently than, I mean, Savannah's got a beautiful historic district, and a lot of what has sort of happened in Savannah has happened since Forrest Gump came to town and everything. But Charleston always seemed like they were a decade or two ahead of Savannah in terms of really capitalizing on those downtown districts. You think so? Does that sound about right?
Yeah. I mean, Charleston was one of the first cities in the country to create a Board of Architectural Review. This was back in the 1920s.
Yeah.
It preserves the historic character of the peninsula and the historic district. And then we also have a design review board that works for the areas outside of downtown, because being in a coastal city, obviously we have to fight Mother Nature a lot, especially as it comes to water.
Yeah.
And we want to make sure that, you know, not only are the historic buildings preserved, but that we're building a resilient city for the future.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, it's a beautiful city. So, Carl, we always ask our guests to come with a big idea or bold opinion. We don't necessarily, you don't have to check it with me. And so what are we talking about today?
Yeah, when I had reached out, I kind of had an idea. Serving on city council has been a unique experience for me, and then obviously working in fundraising. But when I was living in Connecticut, I actually served on a board of education up there as well. And so the big idea was really just to talk about how giving back to your community, whether it's through elected office or through civic service and being on various boards and commissions and that type of thing, can actually really help your fundraising. Even though it is extra time, it can actually help you fundraise.
Yeah, I recently read a book along that line that John Kay is an author, writes a book. He's an economist that teaches at Cambridge, and he talks about how a lot of our goals in life are sort of better achieved sort of in an indirect route. And when I talk to guys like you who sort of play guys or gals, whoever, you know, when you're playing a community role, it doesn't necessarily just say I'm walking around town as a fundraiser, but I've got other things I do. It makes sense that it's a better indirect route to accomplishing many of the things that we as fundraisers are out to accomplish. Does that make sense?
Yeah. I actually kind of part of the impetus for this was I read Give and Take by Adam Grant. And one of the things that his research, and for those that don't know him, he's a organizational psychologist at the Wharton School of Business at the University of Pennsylvania. His research bore out that there's kind of two types of people, givers and takers. Yeah. And takers in the short term seem to get ahead faster because they take of other people's time, talent, and treasure. But when you're playing the long game, which I would argue that fundraising is the long game,
sir.
Those people that give of their time, talent, and treasure to help build up other people, to serve their community, while not being taken advantage of, you know, those are the folks that actually end up being the most successful and creating the most impactful change.
Yeah, I'm wrapping up a book project right now, and I'm thinking, man, I got to go grab a copy of Adam's book, because you're absolutely. I remember reading that Give and Take. I remember reading that a number of years ago and thinking something along that same line. But part of what you're talking about, Carl, and we had a guest on the podcast talk about this, I don't know, 6 or 8 weeks ago. Part of what you're talking about too, which also relates back to the idea of you being embedded in the community in different roles, is the longevity with which you stay in your seat. I mean, some of these fundraisers do, like Grant talks about, you know, if you're a taker and you can immediately take and make some really great, you know, hit some home runs right away, that's one thing. But if you stick around, take an indirect route, you can probably make some miracles happen, don't you think?
That's right. That's right. And, you know, I the way that I kind of approach it is, you know, essentially as a fundraiser, you are a taker in some regards, sure, in terms of you are taking people's, yes, money for the admission advancement of your own organization. But eventually those chickens come home to, yeah, roost, right? Like there's only so much of that that you can walk around representing. And so from my vantage point, being involved in the community is important because when that ask does come of a donor or an organization that I eventually make, it's not just me representing my organization. It's also the things that I've been doing in the community. So when they see I'm in Leadership Charleston, which is a leadership development program for the Charleston Metro Chamber. Mm-hmm. We just did a community garden out at a rural library, and you know, they posted it on Facebook. Some of my fellow participants did as well. And you know, people are able to see that we're out there making a difference in the community, you know, with our free time on a Saturday. And I think it's important that as a fundraiser, you know, I don't look at that as just something extra I have to do. I view it as an integral part of my job to be out there, because there's, and I was just talking about this with a friend of mine who's also a fundraiser the other day, you know, to your point, there is the direct kind of fundraising where, you know, I have a portfolio and I'm building relationships with those donors within my portfolio for the organization.
Yeah.
But it's through these various avenues of being on several boards in the community, you know, working with my Rotary Club, that you indirectly get introduced to people that not necessarily would be in the network of people within my own regular portfolio. And I think, you know, people being able to see that is important, and viewing it as part of the work.
Yeah. Yeah. That's what this guy Kay is talking. So he, like I said, he teaches at Cambridge and he's writing, he's an economist, and he's talking about how, there's a phenomenon that plays out. I think we've historically talked about, Steve Jobs knew this too, when he designed the Apple facilities and so forth, is you create these environments where sort of these serendipitous sort of opportunities happen. And that's essentially what you're talking about in your role. You're in these, you're out and about in town doing multiple roles, but it also creates these serendipitous sort of surprises, which is something that I think, you know, thinking about the project I'm working on right now, you know, if our profession doesn't get more comfortable with sort of the uncertainty and sort of unpredictability of sort of what we're navigating in this world, I don't know that we're ever going to sort of really win out what our opera, you know, I don't think we're ever going to sort of achieve what we really can. Mm-hmm. Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, one of the things I've noticed is, you know, through doing the community involvement the way that I do, you know, it builds my own network as, yeah, well. And so, you know, I think there's something to be said for, you know, we're all held accountable for meeting goals and hitting, sure, projections. And sometimes if you can't get it through the normal method of execution, working your fundraising plan, having your own network that you can call in a favor to, you know, to get a gift, or you know, to get a company to send some volunteers to help out, having that in your own personal network and your own personal repertoire has helped out immensely. You know, I'll give you a perfect example. A lady I used to work with at a previous nonprofit here in Charleston took a role at Blackbaud, and my company, Carolina Youth Development Center, we were working on really trying to ramp up our Giving Tuesday campaign. And so I called this lady I used to work with, who now works at Blackbaud, asked her if Blackbaud would be willing to be a matching gift partner for ours so that we could, you know, double the impact, essentially, because people give more when they know their gift is being matched. And Blackbaud was able to come to the table with a matching gift opportunity for us for Giving Tuesday. And we raised four times more this Giving Tuesday than we did the previous Giving Tuesday. And, you know, part of it was, you know, calling somebody in my network that worked at the company to, you know, facilitate that interaction.
Okay. So I've never sort of thought about it this way. I really do appreciate, and I like the direction you're going with your role as a community leader and as a fundraiser. But I got to balance it with, so I had a, I'll sort of unpack this a little bit. And I'm not in any way picking on Rotarians, but I've been a Rotarian myself. I started a Rotary Club, for example, but I had a development officer that worked for me once that she was utilizing, her view was, is that she was sort of utilizing the Rotary Club as sort of the direct route. I mean, you know what a Rotary Club is, right? We all know what Rotaries are. So we all know. But it was, Rotary became the direct route. And I think there's something, like, you didn't hop on that. You didn't, what is it, a commissioner? Is that what's your title on the...
City councilman.
Yeah, you didn't get on the city council. You didn't get on city council because you were a fundraiser. You get on city council because it was something that you were interested in, something you're good at, you know, somewhere where you could flourish in addition to where you're flourishing at work. But utilizing some of these venues, like she was in the case of Rotary, it sort of soured almost both experiences for herself, and certainly for those on the other side of the table. Do you follow what I'm saying?
Yeah. Well, I think it gets back to my point about if you're viewing it as extra work, it won't have the impact that you're looking to have on the kind of indirect side. But if you view it as kind of the integral part to the job, that, you know, I view it as kind of being a brand ambassador, right? So, like, I carry my organization with me with everything I do, because inevitably, no matter where you are, it comes up, you know, who are you and what do you do?
Yeah.
Right. So that the various pathways that you're able to interact with that, you know, it kind of spreads out the tentacles, so to speak, so that the reach of the organization is far more. But I, to your point, I don't use any of those as kind of the direct route.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it's back to, that's kind of the taker approach. That's not the giver approach.
Yeah, it reminds, so we're all watching the news. You know, you got this big shipping channel, Suez Canal, and that's the direct route. So they dug this big hole and they created this much more direct route, and then you get stuck. And it and I think that's kind of like what we're talking about here. When you take the direct route, I was in a chat room the other day. We were talking about, I mean, we were literally having the same conversation, you know, and the question inevitably comes up, how do you get to major donors? And I'm like, you don't get to major donors. There's no direct route to major donors. What you have to do is you have to be in these spaces where they're at, and it has to become part of your comfort zone. And you sort of have to wait for you have to patiently wait for the opportunity to sort of emerge. I mean, isn't that how it works?
Yes. Yeah, no, I think so. You know, I'll give you a perfect example from my own kind of background. I mentioned I was on the Board of Education in Torrington, Connecticut, which is a city of about 40,000 up in the northwest corner in Litchfield County.
Yeah.
And I happened to be out. Our Board of Education meetings would go until midnight sometimes. And I happened to be out at the Applebee's in Torrington with the Board of Education chair, and just got talking to him about what he did for work. And it turned out he owned a directional boring company, which is a very niche industry. There's not a lot of players in that field. And he got, you know, just let him talk. And he got talking about a couple of vacation homes that he owned. But if you just were looking at him, you know, he would wear a flannel shirt, jeans, and dirty work boots. You would never think that this guy was a multimillionaire walking around. And so he ended up becoming the primary sponsor for a fundraising breakfast that we did for the Boy Scouts when I worked for them. And, you know, he was able to help us take that event from a cute little breakfast that only raised about $4,000 to when I left the Boy Scouts to move to South Carolina. That breakfast was almost making $30,000, you know, with, you know, kind of a almost seven, eightfold increase over the 4 years I was up there. And you know, it was just directly attributable to, you know, serving on the Board of Ed. It wasn't the direct route. I wasn't looking for, you know, major gifts from it. But then just through kind of the sitting around and talking, found a major donor.
Yeah. Yeah. It sounds like, if I'm piecing it together, it sounds like, Carl, your whole professional life has sort of both personally and professionally, your involvement with the Scouts, for example, your experiences up in Connecticut, have been sort of a development of the appreciation of sort of an indirect route and not trying to exploit the obvious, but perhaps explore the, you know, what the possibilities are. I think that's what, if I'm most consistently saying anything here on the podcast, it's this difference between exploitation and exploration. It's this idea that fundraising has become so exploitive in the sense that I think those on both sides of the exchange. So those of us on the fundraising side feel exploited by our employers, misunderstood, and sometimes exploited by the donors. And then the donors feel like they're being exploited as if they're an ATM machine. And I think if we both approach it, and I have to say, I think I've experienced this with major donors as well. I think if we both came to the table with a more of an exploratory mindset, like we're going to explore the possibilities of where this might go, and we might even surprise ourselves, and we might even find out that we don't even find any treasure. You know, we're out in the, you know, we're like traveling around in the jungle or something, and we know something's out there, but we don't know exactly what we're looking for. Am I picking up that maybe life has taught you that, and that if life has taught you that, that's kind of a skill set that we ought to be trying to identify amongst more of our people?
Yeah, I think so. And I'll, you know, you mentioned the employer side feeling exploited, and I think, you know, I want to be clear, not every employer has embraced the kind of community involvement fundraiser idea. Yep. You know, because again, some of them view it as just a distraction away from, you know, sit down, go to the directory, work the portfolio only. And I think that's to the detriment of, you know, any cause. Because if you really look, you know, and the Chronicle of Philanthropy puts out their yearly report. I mean, charitable giving remains around $700 billion, give or take a few.
Yeah.
But there's not been any type of exponential growth from it. And part of me wonders if that's because the approach isn't changing. You know, we talk about a lot. If most donors give to kind of five organizations, and then here in South Carolina, the top two are the church, your local church and your alma mater. And my tact is always, you know, I just want to be in the conversation for the other three.
Right. Right.
Like, I don't mind if I'm fifth, but you know, I'd like to be in that conversation. And, you know, it's just really, really kind of to the detriment of the employer not looking at the kind of long-term future play that, you know, yeah, I could probably get $100 from, you know, someone in my Rotary Club right now, but is it worth playing the long game and having that become a major gift of, you know, major gift relationship and or really developing a partnership and kind of going that route? Because I'll give you a perfect example. And I just had this conversation this morning where I think a lot of nonprofits have this idea that if a donor comes with a major amount of money, they'll find a way to get it in terms of they'll go create a program that they may not be good at to capitalize on getting a gift. Yeah. And I've always said, you know, I think that people can, you know, how Spider-Man has his Spidey sense. I think people have the tingling sensation when they know that they're being misled. And, you know, so if someone came to me and, you know, I predominantly work in human services, but if someone came to me and said that they wanted to help save the spotted owls, you know, some people would try and find a way to create a program that would optimize that. But my tact is more, you know, there's a couple of nonprofits here in town that deal with, you know, helping out birds specifically and then kind of endangered species. And, you know, I'm more than happy to refer them to my friends from the Association of Fundraising Professionals chapter that are at those organizations. And, you know, I can tell you, and this has been at every organization I've worked for, I've had interactions like that. And the organization that I work for, 9 times out of 10, will get a check from that person because the thank you note usually goes something of, you know, thanks for connecting us to this organization. They're wonderful. We really appreciated the referral. You know, here's a check to help out your organization. And for referring us to the other one. And so, you know, I that's more the approach that I kind of like to take, because I think people can spot disingenuous people pretty easily.
Yeah, I mean, in some ways, you're getting at, you know, if we think about this from sort of a supervisory sort of standpoint, I think the biggest issue I have with the way that most supervisors approach this is, A, they haven't spent a lot of time themselves in the field doing the work, and so they can't really relate, and they can't really provide a guy like you with a halfway decent set of constructive feedback in terms of how things go. They just pat you on the back and say, thanks for collecting the check. But I think what we also have to uncover is that if we know that fundraising works better in sort of an indirect way, what we also are relinquishing when we do that is control, which inevitably arrives at fear.
That's right.
And fundraising is oftentimes a fearful job anyway. And so do we really want to compound the fear factor by necessarily always relying on a direct approach? I think we've got a lot of highly relationship driven people out there for whom are very fearful of messing up a relationship far more than they're concerned about whether you write them a check. And when the boss is a control freak who can only tolerate a direct route, I mean, these are some of the sort of the environmental sort of considerations I think we're not really sort of wrestling with when we talk about turnover, for example. I mean, we see these studies repeatedly coming out. Mm-hmm. People turn, you know, they want to quit. They want to quit. Well, sure, they want to quit because the boss is a control freak and they don't understand that most of this gets done indirectly. Am I right?
I think that's true. And, you know, turnover is something that I'm a big reader about as well. Because I think just nonprofits in general, you know, I think it's the lens that I come at the turnover angle from is as a fiduciary steward of the organization, right? And someone who's responsible for responsibly spending the donor's money. When you have high turnover, and we know it costs more to recruit and train somebody new than it does to keep just an average performer. But a lot of organizational executives, turnover and churn aren't even part of their evaluation. And, you know, knowing in fundraising, what gets measured is what gets done.
Yeah.
And so if an organizational executive, you know, whether it's an ED or a CEO, if that's not part of their evaluation every year, then it's not something that they really care about all that much. But from my lens, trying to raise money, you know, I find it hard to talk with a donor about being a responsible steward of their money when we know on the back end that we're not able to keep and retain talent and that we're spending more money than we need to try and keep those positions filled.
I never thought about that, Carl. You're absolutely right. And it reminds me of some research that I put into the first book, the idea that healthcare executives or those evaluating healthcare facilities, for example, learned a long time ago that the quality of care that we give our this is messy, Carl. The quality of care that we give patients is oftentimes a direct reflection or correlates with the quality of care that hospital executives give their nurses. So basically what the research shows is that how well a hospital takes care of its nursing staff is also an indication, you know, is an indirect way of assessing how well a patient is taken care of. Well, the same, and I remember thinking about this, and I'm listening to what you're saying here, and I'm reminded of that thought that if we stopped focusing, because you know we love to talk about renewal rates in this sector, in this space, I mean, how well are you renewing your donors? Well, to renew a donor is to basically say to keep them around. Well, if we focus more on evaluating, instead of evaluating renewal rates every year, we held a boss accountable to renewing his, making sure that Carl stayed on the payroll, we take a cue from the healthcare world about taking, you know, if a nurse sticks around for a while, he or she provides a level of care to that patient. I want the same thing for my donors.
Right. You know, I'll give you a perfect example. So my dad works for McDonald's Corporation, the hamburger company, and he oversees 23 stores that the company owns and operates. Yeah. And part of his scorecard is that he can't have a turnover rate higher than 10%. And that's not just the people that are his direct reports. That goes all the way down to the part-time fry kid
that's
16 years
old.
Brilliant. The organization that his vertical can only have 10%.
Yeah.
because they know exactly what we described, where it costs more to recruit and train new employees than it does to keep just an average performer. And, you know, when especially the joke that he always likes to say, you know, is that, you know, McDonald's didn't go from the first store in Des Plaines, Illinois, to a multi-billion dollar company without knowing where the money went. And so keeping and retaining talent is an organizational priority because it's an unnecessary spending of money if they can just keep.
Yeah. I mean, how many, I have never thought about it this way. It's not all that complex, but you're absolutely right, Carl. If we held the nonprofit CEOs accountable to retaining their development directors, because the other thing we know is that the development directors that leave are, they're not, I mean, granted, there's probably a few of them that are not all that talented, and that's why they go, and we have to let them go, and rightfully so. But like you're talking about at McDonald's, it's oftentimes the top performers, it's the people who are very valued that are the ones that we least like to see go. And so if I'm the right. chairperson on the board who says, hey, you know, why does your development officer development shop completely turn over all the time? Perhaps I'm picking up on certainly I'm picking up on an explanation for why we're not achieving our fundraising goals, because it tends to be very much focused on you're not raising enough money and you never have a development officer in this seat very consistently. Well, perhaps we need to be thinking about does that CEO, you know, have any idea? You know, that raises a question. So, Carl, you've been around long enough. Do you think some of that is going to work itself out in 10 years when, you know, more guys like you and me are, you know, I mean, I have people on here all the time that have been in the space for 10, 15, 20 years, but they're not quite in the senior most leadership roles. They're not the CEOs right. yet. But I think we got a lot of nonprofit CEOs that just haven't learned some of the stuff that we've talked about. And perhaps when a guy or gal like yourself lands in a CEO spot, some of this is just going to work itself out.
I think part of that argument works.
Yeah.
In terms of, you know, driving the organizational change will require folks to get hired into those seats that have that type of mindset.
Yeah.
Yeah, but one of the things I think, and speaking of, you know, this was a couple of jobs ago, but my vice president ended up leaving and I had to fill in the interim capacity, and I was supervising a couple of, it's always hard to go from colleague to supervisor.
Yes, yes.
And so I was supervising a couple of colleagues that I previously kind of worked with, and one of them was kind of fearful for her portfolio that year. And I told her, and I think this gets to the point about how you can reduce turnover and have, you know, an honest conversation with people. And I told this person, if you can show me that you worked the process, that you did the moves management with your portfolio, and you end up 5-7% away from the goal, you know, you're within spitting distance, but you can show me that you worked the process, then that's what I'm going to evaluate you on, is did you do the best with the cards that you were dealt? Because we know that there's going to be natural attrition. You know, people are going to die. People are going to move. You know, some people are going to lose their job. Some people have a life event happen where, you know, they have a kid and they have to reduce their charitable contributions. We know all of that can play into it. But if you can show me that you had a process that you followed and you worked, then that's what I'm going to evaluate you on, because it isn't always about an arbitrary number that gets picked out of the sky usually, as opposed to a thoughtful evaluation of, you know, I've seen too many times in my career where whatever you raised last year, just draw the line there and it's going to go up 7%.
Yeah.
You know, and that's not how we should be holding fundraisers accountable.
Yeah, and I've said that in a number of my seminars, and I'm generally trying to say that as boldly as I can and in front of as many people as possible. We have drawn and this gets back to Kay's book and some of the stuff that you've been talking about here today. We're so outcome focused, right? So we want to raise X number of dollars. So we draw a straight, linear, direct line directly to that. And we don't really give a damn about what the process looks like in between point A and point B, when in fact what we know as fundraisers, and certainly what our bosses need to grasp, is that whether we even arrive at B, the process is ultimately what gets us there. And I don't That's think right. we have enough. And I don't know that there's more fundraisers necessarily than bosses that have really gotten a grasp of the fact that fundraising is a much more, is better understood as a process oriented work than an outcome oriented work. And I know our sector has just been, you know, banging the drum for being outcome focused and give your donors these outcome indicators and that sort of stuff. And I can appreciate all that. But when it comes to the actual work of fundraising, it's the process that we're paying people to do. Quite frankly, I can't leap across that lunch table and make Mrs. Smith write that check. I don't care what outcome I'm looking right. for. I can't control that particular outcome. I can only control the process. Yeah.
Yeah. And I think it gets into, you know, what we kind of were talking about is the bold idea of being involved in the community is the indirect yeah. route. You know, we know just like with marketing, you have to be kind of touched 7 times with a marketing touch to even remember what the company is doing. And it's, you know, the same thing, the donor needs kind of 7 touches, before we ask for money. Cause you know, it's just like dating, right? Like, you know, you don't just meet and get married. There's a process that you kind of follow. And you know, I think it's a lot of that. And that's where the community involvement side comes in is, it's being able to put yourself in spaces where, you know, some of the donors in my portfolio, you know, I will see out at the various things that we're doing, especially when some of the nonprofits I'm on the boards for, they do their galas and stuff. Like, we share donors. So I'm going to get to see them. And it's an additional touch in the community where I'm not asking for money. You know, I'm just bumping into them at the gala, chatting with them, you know, how their kids are doing, what their wife's up to. And it's a touch without an expectation of an ask behind it. So that then when you do meet with Mrs. Smith over lunch, they've seen you around enough times and interacted enough times when it's not necessarily you as, you know, Joe fundraiser, with an expectation that there could be an ask following. You know, you've had the touches where you haven't. And then when you sit down and make the actual ask at the lunch table, it's a much friendlier conversation.
No, oh my, are we dare suggesting that fundraisers ought to be ensuring that they themselves recognize themselves as human beings? I'm reminded of, so a friend of mine, Beth Breeze, teaches philanthropy, runs a philanthropy department at the University of Kent in Canterbury. And she wrote a book a couple of years ago, I think published in 2018. And she taught, one of the things I very much appreciated about Beth's book is she pointed out this one little detail that I had never heard, but it's exactly what we're talking about. And that fundraisers oftentimes end up in places like on choirs. And in your case, they end up on the city council and stuff. They're human beings. And sometimes right. we on the soliciting side need to remind ourselves that being involved in the community and sitting on this local board and singing in a choir, I think one of the drums that I've been beating the last couple of weeks with my guest is the idea that I think we're going to see a much more qualitative turn in fundraising practices in this sort of this post-pandemic economy. And I think that's one of the ways that we need to look at ourselves is that we're human beings and that the more you can sort of enhance your humanness and not be some, you know, soliciting robot all the time. I mean, gee whiz, I have to imagine, Carl, that if you and I sat on the, you know, the city council there in Charleston together, regardless of whether I even give a damn about the organization that you represent, I'm probably far more likely to listen to you and give it consideration just because you and I are doing something meaningful together as two human beings.
That's right. Yep. Yeah, no, and that's absolutely right. And I think it works that, especially just on city council in general, you know, it works that way with a lot of us. As an example, one of the guys on city council owns his own insurance agency, and a lot of the guys on city council get their insurance.
Of course they do.
Because, you know, like it's just the nature. And then, you know, some of the guys are lawyers and, you know, some of us use them for, you know, getting your will done and stuff like that. Like, it's just a natural part of the interaction. Cause in some weeks, especially during the start of the pandemic, when we were having emergency meetings pretty much every day. I mean, I was seeing guys on council more than I was seeing my wife during those weeks, you know? And so you get to know people really well.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of the research. So a lot of this is extraordinary conversation, Carl, because I haven't been able to talk about on the podcast yet in 250 plus episodes. We haven't been able to advocate for what we might call the indirect route. So I'm very grateful for this. But a lot of this, you know, originates at the beginning of the early 20th century when we were building assembly lines, manufacturing, you know, Ford's automobiles and so forth. Those are direct routes. And so if right. your way of thinking is linear and straight, and you think it's going to work that way, you're either going to make your donors feel like they're stuck in a machine, or you're in a machine, or you're a robot. You know, I even had Carl. Have you heard this? Have you heard some development offices actually refer to the process as like production? They actually use language that just sounds like an assembly line. Have you heard that stuff?
Right. I have. Yeah. I mean, it's in reference to your performance. Like, what is your production?
Yeah. It's just machine language.
X, Y, or Z dollars. That's
yeah. And I know exactly who said it, and I'm not going to be too specific, and I respect the guy, but he was using language that I was like, man, you are just really using some output input machine language that makes us all just sound like we're, you know, just robots on an assembly line. No wonder we're afraid of losing our jobs, because you're basically making it sound like if we can automate every part of who we are. I think that's what excites me about this line of work and the type of the particular category of work that we're talking about here within the sort of under the umbrella of fundraising, is that this is the part of fundraising that cannot be done. Cannot be automated. You cannot automate having lunch with Mrs. Smith right. and asking her for $1,000.
One of the organizations I sit on the board for was looking to hire a major gifts officer. And so, you know, me working in fundraising as a career, they brought me in to help their director of development craft the kind of job performance measures in terms of how this, whoever they ended up hiring, would be evaluated. Yeah. And I think it gets into, you know, and there's plenty of people that I've worked with over the years that, you know, 7 meetings a week in person is the gold standard.
Sure.
And I pushed back on that. And I had kind of, when I was helping this organization craft the way that their MGO is going to be evaluated, I said, you know, you have to think of it instead of, you're not always going to have the coffee or the lunch meeting. But the way to evaluate this person, and this is how I'd crafted it, was 3 to 7 meaningful interactions a week.
Yeah.
With a donor or potential donor.
Yeah.
That you've qualified, 3 to 7 meaningful interactions, not meeting for, you know, not a meeting, because I think as you know, the kind of millennial and Gen Xers move higher sure. in terms of the percentage of the giving population, I can have just as meaningful a conversation via text with somebody, especially if it's my age. They don't want to talk to me on the phone. They don't necessarily want to carve out an hour, hour and a half of their workday to go sit and have lunch.
Yeah.
You know, anything that helps move towards closing a gift is really what that person should be evaluated on, not just are they getting meetings for meeting's
yeah.
sake. And I think that that's the production end of that, of thinking of it like an assembly line. Like, you want me to set meetings? I can just go set meetings. But is it about setting the meeting, or is it about actually moving the conversation forward and the relationship forward with
that
donor?
No, that's a whole nother. So I've been reading a book. I've been reading a book by a woman named Kathleen Allen, and she's a ecologist. And she talks about how different ecologies. So you think about the cornfield behind my house here, and it's an ecology that's basically an ecosystem that's basically designed to sap all of the nutrients out of the ground and give nothing back. And then there's sort of this what she calls a type 2 ecology, which sort of exists sort of in between the other two. But this third ecology is what she calls a generous ecology. It's an ecosystem that gives back as much as it takes. And that's essentially what we've been talking about this whole time, is that when you take a more indirect route
right.
and you engage in the community and you sit on you know, city councils or the local church choir or something, you're actually able to contribute to the community just as much as you expect the community to contribute to you. And that's how,
that's how
old growth trees work. And that's how a thriving forest works, right? Is that, you know, the beautiful trees and the forest and everything, it becomes extremely sustainable and thrives because everything is being generous back and forth. It's not just one directional.
Yeah. And I think it gets into the idea of, and I don't know how you would get a vice president for advancement to necessarily buy into this idea. But it builds social capital, yep, right? And social capital is a, yep, well, and you have to refill the, yep, well. You can't let it run dry because then it makes your job even, yep, harder.
Yeah, man. It sounds like we're reading a lot of the same books. We're at 42 minutes. We're at 42 minutes and we officially lose our listeners at about 45. So I'm going to wrap this up. You are always welcome back, yeah, Carl. If somebody's listening to us and they want to follow up, they say, hey, I'm in the Charleston area and I want to buy you lunch or buy you a cup of coffee or something. Maybe they just want to follow up on a thought that you offered today. How would you suggest that they reach out to you?
Yeah, I can give you my my personal email. It's Carl, K-A-R-L dot Brady, B-R-A-D-Y, 1, like the number 1, at gmail.com.
Great, Carl. And I'll also put a link to your LinkedIn profile when we post this on LinkedIn.
Yeah,
and that'll be great. That'll get people to you there as well. Carl, it's been a pleasure.
Pleasure, Jason. Thanks so much.
Have you read the book that nonprofit leaders and fundraising professionals alike are calling a must-read? In this pocket manifesto for today's fundraising professional, Jason deconstructs why many of us find ourselves working for organizations where we cannot accomplish our goals. These same organizations are notorious for rapid turnover and high donor attrition. To avoid this all-too-familiar path, Jason offers direction from those who want to be recognized and admired for their work. The war for fundraising talent challenges our ingrained beliefs and assumptions about how effective fundraising really works, and it questions the prevailing wisdom hiring decisions and donor behavior. Published by Gatekeepers Press, The War for Fundraising Talent is now available on Amazon and other major retailers. We want to thank you for listening to today's episode of the Fundraising Talent Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you will come back for next week's interview, where we will discuss with those on the front line who are defining what it means to be a fundraising professional. If you'd like to be a guest on the Fundraising Talent Podcast, visit our Facebook page or email Jason at jason@lewisfundraising.com. In your email, be sure to tell us about where you work and why you believe you would be a great addition to the upcoming lineup. Thank you again for joining us today, and we look forward to you being a part of the continuing conversation as we shape how the nonprofit sector thinks about fundraising talent.